So this is talking with Jack Piddington at National Measurements Lab in Sydney on 13th March 78. So could you go back and tell me what your educational background was, and then you came back to Australia, I know, and then how you got involved with radio work?
Well, I was trained as an engineer at Sydney University and then went to Cambridge working with Appleton on ionospheric research. Returned to Australia in 1938 and worked in the Department of Electrical Engineering until the beginning of the radio physics lab at 1940.
At the University of Sydney?
This was in Sydney. Prior to the war, Martin and I had speculated on the possibility of thermal radiation, detecting thermal radiation from the sun. It wasn't the moon, it was the sun, I remember now. And we'd made some elementary attempts. We could easily have seen the bursts, but we didn't realise this, like a lot of people. Missed out on that easy one. And we couldn't detect thermal radiation. With the beginning of the war, all efforts were then directed to radar, and the techniques were advanced enormously. Initially, mainly from Britain, and then later from the United States, from their radiation lab.
Right, let me just go back to this attempt to detect the sun. Roughly what frequency was that?
The shortest wavelength in those days that we could work on was about 5 meters.
And you wanted to go to the shortest wavelength?
Yes, we...
And for what reason was that?
Well, we worked out that the signal-to-noise ratio would increase with frequency.
And were you thinking, was your calculation of the signal based on a 6,000 Kelvin black body?
Yes.
And you never published this result or anything?
We were so far short that it didn't seem worthwhile publishing.
Right. But you did make the try. You put the aerial up and...
Yes. Well, we used aerials that were up. We were doing a lot of ionospheric work with some rather directional aerials. Frequency was much too low with the techniques available in those days.
Can you remember, can you just tell me what kind of aerial it was? An array of Yagis or something like this?
It wasn't Yagis, it was half-wave dipoles, several half-wave dipoles at the right height above the ground, a quarter-wave bank, I think, out at Liverpool on a flat plain at Liverpool where most of the ionospheric work was done. I'd also built a radar set in the university grounds. That was the first radar set in Australia, because I'd worked on radar with Appleton in England. At a colonial, I wasn't given access to their techniques, but I was allowed to cooperate on a sort of vague basis.
I see.
That they'd come and see me and tell me what to do, and I'd do it, and then write a report and tell them. I had aeroplanes flying around at Cambridge and getting echoes and using the BBC television transmitter, just transmitting a white picture. So it was a sort of reverse radar technique. They would send a continuous signal, yeah, interrupted by the line timing signal.
Right.
And that was the pulse. We got all sorts of interference patterns, and quite intriguing.
But you were using this to study the ionosphere, the radar, or...?
No, this was for radar.
To develop radar?
Yes, to study the reflection coefficients of aeroplanes, basically.
I see.
And we were getting reflections. In those days, we didn't realise that the current through a transmitting valve could be increased from a matter of a few amps up to thousands of amperes. It was easy to calculate with the techniques then. The radar was worthless. It would give you a range of about 10 miles, perhaps 20 miles. And it was Watson Watt, who knew so little about it, that he pushed it. And then technicians at Mullard and so on, they developed the microwave, micropup, we call it, a little valve about that long, that would transmit 10 kilowatts, which is unthinkable.
Hmm. So,
and that was radar.
Sometimes too much knowledge is...
Yes.
Hurts.
Yeah.
But how was it you were a student at Cambridge getting a degree in ionospheric research. How was it that you got involved in the reflection coefficient of airplanes?
Well, Appleton had access to the information. It was extremely secret otherwise, and we had guessed what they were doing. It was pretty obvious to people working in that area. It was the pulse technique that we used for ionospheric work, and we easily worked out, assuming a reasonable sort of reflectivity of aeroplanes, we worked out the range you'd expect, and it was, the whole thing was worthless. We could see that. But nevertheless, they are going ahead with it energetically. Luckily, they did. And so through Appleton, who was anxious to get into it, he was anxious to get into everything he reasonably could, I did these experiments at Cambridge using the Alexander Palace television transmitter in London, 50 miles away.
Well, that's interesting. Just a couple more questions now also about this attempt on the sun. This array looked at the zenith, I guess, dipoles. And so did you wait for a time when the sun went through the zenith?
Yes. That was no trouble. Also, the sun, even in midsummer, is still 10 degrees away from the zenith. Well, that was neither here nor there with the directivity we had.
Mm-hmm. And you simply looked at the strip chart recording to see if there was any noticeable change. Well, that's the first time I've heard of that. That's interesting. But that was it. You just spent a day or two and didn't try to change frequencies or anything like this.
No.
So, now going back to your work once the war started, the radiophysics lab grew rapidly, and I know you were one of the key people working there. Can you tell me the sort of things that you worked on?
Well, I was responsible for the design of the radar sets. That was the basic basis of the whole radiophysics laboratory, really. One or two sets were Chinese copies of English sets, but the only successful one that was ever developed in Australia, the only really successful one, was LWAW, Lightweight Air Warning. We spent a lot of time developing one for the Army that eventually was a very good set and would direct the fire of the coast defence guns, ships, but of course they were never used. But the air warning one was essential, and that was developed in the week following the following Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, we were in that particular hurry. The English were doing their stuff over there, and they'd sent us some what I call junk, weighing, if I recall, 45 tons, I think, for one air warning set. And we'd already foreseen that if the Japanese came into the war, we'd need some air transportable equipment. And on the basis of the coast defence set, I'd outlined a rough design, and on the Monday morning, it was Monday here, I had a team of 14 men who started work day and night to get this thing going, and on Saturday night, at about 8 o'clock, we got it working at Dover Heights, which you've heard about from radiophysics, which was the site of a lot of experiments later on the sun and so on.
So it was 6 days later then?
Yes. That's the most peculiar story, because the coast defence people had sponsored that. It was in a coast defence area, which we had to have for secrecy. And they manned it. It was the only air warning set in Sydney for 9 months after that, even after the Americans came. There was nothing. The aeroplanes were just rolling in. Any Japanese could have come in and would only have been detected visually. But when we officially tried to transfer that to the Army, to the Signal Corps, or who'd look after it, they refused to man it on the grounds that it was dangerous.
I see.
Which it was, of course. There were 10,000 volts floating around on some course. Anyway, we gradually improved that, and at the same time, it went into production, and there were several, I think three models were turned out as fast as possible. One of those was sent to Darwin. Some of my team had been sent with it, we could have met the Japanese raid on Darwin that wrecked the whole town and sank every ship in the harbour.
Hmm.
Easily, as soon as we got it going. And the day I was there, on a Sunday morning, we finally twisted the last screw. It had been set up. It was set up long before this.
Yes.
But the Air Force didn't have any people able to tune the aerial, and Brian Cooper went up with me. And it took us several days. Well, he did most of the work, and I just would look after things generally. And on the Sunday morning, half an hour after we got the thing going, I was still thinking about taking it off the air again to get rid of some false blips. And then I thought, well, it doesn't really matter, that we can work through those. And we picked up a raid at 86 miles.
I see.
Which wasn't very good, but still, it was quite good enough in those days. The Japanese obligingly used to come over all the time. Every raid was done at 18,000 feet, which was lovely for us.
Yes.
Couldn't have been better for that particular wavelength. And that raid was broken up, and there were only one or two Japs shot down. But that was because the American squadron that was 50 miles south of Darwin had no prior combat, and they needed training. After that, there was never another successful raid on Darwin.
I see.
And that could have actually applied to the first raid had we been invited by the Air Force to go and get the thing working.
And so did you continue this sort of radar set development all throughout the war?
Yes. Up to 1944, we'd had everything here developed as far as seemed necessary. And even the Americans had accepted a lot of our air warning sets. Theirs were probably technically as good, but they're much heavier. We could put the entire LWAW into a DC-3, aerial and all.
And it was very rugged and reliable, I understand, also. That's another...
Yes.
For the tropics and so on.
Hello. This is Professor Sullivan, Dr. Giovanelli.
Oh, hello.
We're doing a recording on radio astronomy.
And so this set, which proved quite useful and successful, was one of the main things you worked on?
Yes, we introduced Mark 2 and Mark 3 and so on, but the techniques then had been worked out to a degree that we could foresee any other developments. They depended on types of valves that became available. But in the meantime, it became evident that Britain was coming to start operations in India and Burma, and they'd be faced with the same difficulties that we'd overcome in New Guinea and some of the islands. The obvious one being deterioration in very humid, hot climates. But we'd worked this out, so I went to England to the Telecommunications Research Establishment, which was the equivalent of the radiation lab.
Right.
For some months in 1944, and worked there, more or less told them what was required, and together we worked out two radar sets that would be used in Burma and that could operate there.
I see.
That was all wasted, of course. But
can you just very briefly just tell me what adaptations did you need to make? Did you spray things, or what exactly did you do?
Most of the components, even spraying wasn't sufficient, they'd had to be hermetically sealed, and a large development of techniques of hermetically sealing all spare components and spraying.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall any particular details. We were also ahead on the techniques of radar techniques for use in areas like New Guinea, which was closer to the requirements in Burma than those from England and the continent.
Sure, sure.
And so together we worked out two sets. One, I think, was 10 centimetres, and one was 25 centimetres. In those days, I decided that 25 centimetres was the ideal wavelength for aircraft detection. Just a nice compromise.
Between technology and resolving power and so forth?
Yes.
Yeah. But I have here this thing that you wrote in 1940, December, about radio echoes from the moon. So you found a couple odd moments to think about these scientific matters. Can you tell me how this came about?
Well, from time to time, having been concerned with radar echoes from the ionosphere and also the detection of solar radiation, it naturally occurred to me to think about the possibilities of that could be one of the very early efforts in radio astronomy, I suppose.
I think so. I don't know of anybody earlier writing down these sort of things anyway. Maybe somebody else worked them out. And you conclude in this paper that you need 150 megawatts from a dipole to give one microvolt per meter. And I guess that's what you decided you needed. A 16-element array would then need 94 kilowatts. Such an installation is quite within our RDF capabilities at the present moment. But you never, even towards the end of the war, for the hell of it, tried to organize such a thing?
I wouldn't have been allowed. The war, you must realize that then the war was an obsession, and quite naturally so, and it was with me. That was just an idle moment, you might say. But the thought of beating the Japanese and finishing the war was sure. Always present, and anything that detracted from that was not encouraged at all.
Right. Did you learn about Hayes' report during the war? Do you remember?
No, I think it was after the war that we first heard about that.
Do you remember any other, maybe not written down, but any other thoughts during the war of going back and trying to detect the sun or other things?
No, I was more concerned then with the application of the radar techniques to the sort of thing that radiophysics is doing now, to aircraft traffic control, and to, well, that includes guidance systems and so on, and also to long-range surveys. We actually got into that field.
I see.
For a while. That was what I thought radiophysics should do after the war. Now they're tending to do that. A little, that seemed to me to be more their role. But the great success of radio astronomy naturally led them to more and more application in that area.
Okay, well, let's move on to the end of the war. And as you say, the role of radiophysics was not clear at all as to which way it should go. And I gather then that you would have preferred something that was more applied at that stage.
Yes, I wrote several reports when I was in England, and when I came back I was radiation lab for a few months also, later in 1944, strongly encouraged the application, particularly to survey. Well, we did some we did some of that work, and we also developed some aircraft navigational aids. One in particular called distance measuring equipment, I think led the world at that stage, DME.
Right.
And as far as I know, well, I remember I held the patent for that. This was the CSIRO policy to take out a patent in the name of the person who developed it.
I see.
Not to use it themselves, but to stop other people patenting it. And now DME, of course, is in every aircraft in Australia, even private planes.
When you say surveying, do you mean using radar for topographical maps and that sort of thing?
Well, basically for measuring the distance between 2 points thousands of kilometres apart. And that can be done with one aircraft in the middle, height known, and then radar from, from the two
points. So it's for map making, though, and this sort of thing?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So what, in fact, did you work on primarily after the war?
Well, that's what I was working on. And then that was discouraged. That line of work was discouraged, and I was asked to go to radio astronomy. And the first effort I can remember in that area was I'd been instrumental in getting a 1.25 centimeter set from. Well, I think you developed it at the radiation lab.
Right.
And I was given that with a the aerial with a searchlight mirror, which was coated, metallically coated, 1 meter in diameter, so it wasn't a very wonderful aerial, but still, it wasn't that bad. And with that, we did those first experiments on the moon.
Right.
They weren't the earliest. You'll know that Dickey.
They were not the earliest measurement, but of course they were the first to do it over several lunations and to really get into the physics of it all.
Yeah.
By the way, did you talk with Dickey at all? Do you have any remembrances from that at the radiation lab?
No, I never met him.
I see.
I was working with in the group of Purcell.
Mm-hmm. Who enters radio astronomy under a different field, of course, later on.
Yeah.
So it's not fair to say at all, then, that although you were using the radiation lab's receiver, that your work is not growth of Dickey's work at similar wavelengths. It's not fair to say that your work is an outgrowth of Dickey's at similar wavelengths.
Oh, we'd have done it anyhow. I mean,
yeah.
It's so obvious. We were going to do with the sun and the galaxy, and of course the moon was the easiest one to start with. Calculations there were quite simple.
But is it correct to say that the receiver was basically one developed at the radiation lab?
Yes.
Now, so this experiment was carried out in 1947, I believe. No, April and June 48, during three lunar cycles. And you apparently were brought into radio astronomy somewhat reluctantly, but this paper has some very interesting results. Did this whet your appetites some more?
Yes. Once I got involved, I became more and more interested, and only a few years later, I noticed here in 1950, I was writing theoretical papers on the solar.
Right.
And it was unfortunate for me that I started at the very high frequency end because the techniques then were not quite good enough. They were marginally good enough.
Right.
They were virtually useless for galactic work. We did a little with Harry Manette.
At 1200 megahertz, I think you made a...
Yes, we gradually upped our wavelength, decreased our frequency. We did solar radiation at 10 centimeters, Jim Heinemann.
Right.
1949. Well, that wasn't spectacular because the wavelength there, again, was still too short.
But still, these points, even though they may not have had the highest signal-noise ratio, they give vital information on the spectrum of various objects.
Well, that's true, particularly of the sun. It did give the highest frequency point on the solar emission, and then that led to my theoretical paper.
On the sun, Piddington in minutes in 51.
Now, here's one, the derivation of a model solar chromosphere from radio data.
What year?
That's 1950.
Yes, I think I have a reprint of that here, yes. And here you talk about deriving from 600 to 24,000 megacycles the black body radiation from the sun. Now, how does this differ fundamentally from the work that SMERD was doing about the same time? Were you two operating more or less independently, or what?
SMERD was a little later, I think.
No, I don't actually have the date here, but I think it's just about parallel.
SMERD didn't arrive... the model atmosphere.
Now that's true. He assumed various things and calculated ray paths, I believe.
Yes. He followed D.F. Martin, who was the first one to attempt an explanation in terms of a non-black body, an atmosphere.
With a hot corona.
Hot corona, and you've got a certain amount of absorption of a ray going in, and then partial reflection, and that gave you the theory of the emission. Well, SMERD simply extended Martin's work.
And so the key here in this paper is the development of the model for the corona and the chromosphere and what comes from where. And
yes, I developed the first model that used the radio data. And the radio data was essential. There are other models being developed, and if you tested them with the radio data, you found immediately that they failed.
Dismally. I see. And so what new concepts came in then as a result of this work?
Well, the data, unfortunately, finishing at the high frequency, that was still rather high in the chromosphere. But even so, that was it caused a moderate stir in those days among theorists.
What did it actually change about the knowledge of the sun? I mean, did it make the chromosphere hotter or higher or larger?
Well, there are a whole collection.
You have a plot of electric. I've got it right here. You have a plot of temperature versus height in the corona, for instance.
But there's a later paper in the Astrophysical Journal. Have you got a copy of that?
No, I don't.
Well, that's where I compare various models that were developed by Woolley and Allen.
I see.
How much you like to put my hands on it?
Yes, that was in 54 in Apjay. I have a note of it here.
No, I can't follow that way.
Well, that's all right. I can check that paper if that really does the comparison. Yeah.
That will give you a sort of a background of the whole thing. And then we knew at that time that these models were idealized, assumed sort of spherically symmetrical, which we knew obviously was not true. And attempts were made to develop 2 and 3. Component models, and it got more and more complicated then. But at that stage, the radio data became less and less important because it didn't have the resolution.
Right.
But still, that was a beginning.
But now, you implied in this 1950 paper that it changed what one thought about the chromosphere, and that some people got upset or had to take cognizance of this. That implies that the optical solar theorists and observers were listening to a radio-oriented person at this time. Is that true?
It is. They were disagreeing. I gave a lecture at Stromland, and Woolley disagreed emphatically. I don't know whether you've met him, but if he disagrees emphatically, the roof goes off. They had a model there based on a whole variety of optical evidence and a lot of theorising that went up much steeper than mine. You'll find that in the 1954 paper.
There's temperature that versus height?
Yes. This goes up almost vertically like that. Mine went up like that.
And was this actually Woolley's work?
Or I think Allen probably did.
Clay Allen, yeah.
But the paper was published as Woolley and Allen.
Right.
About 1954, I suppose.
I see.
But other people were intrigued by it. I was for a while with Leo Galberg in Michigan, I think.
Mm-hmm, right.
He was intrigued by it and tried to use the same techniques for doing an optical analysis, but it's far more complicated. The radio emission measure is a very simple expression.
So it seems to me that you're saying that as early as the late 40s and 1950 that optical and radio solar astronomers were talking to each other and listening to each other's results somewhat. Is that a fair statement? I'm trying to get an idea of how the two fields melded together or were distinct.
Well, I can remember in the very early days we were outcasts, which is natural enough. If you've worked as a professional for many years in an area and you find some interloper who knows nothing about the traditional astronomy, a certain amount of bias. But the first I can remember very well is in 1956 when I visited about 20 or 30 observatories and universities from Cambridge and in Washington, Ann Arbor, California, and so on. And at that time, of course, it had been thoroughly accepted.
Yeah. But when you say you were outcast, what sort of ways did this manifest itself in the beginning?
Well, people would tend to ignore our papers, I suppose, that's the way I remember.
Okay, let's go back to through your papers, go back to the moon paper, where you followed the moon around for 3 months, and you found that the peak-to-peak variations was like 80 kelvins and a phase lag of 45 degrees. With respect to the lunar phase. Where did the ideas come for how to go about the analysis for this? Was it all very straightforward, or how did that come about?
Well, you'd start then with a single homogeneous moon and work out the that phase change that we'd observed, and you found that you couldn't account for it. So I think it was natural then to try two, or perhaps more, but two was as far as the data could be stretched. I mean, right. Would make a three-component lunar model. And then we found that the two-component model, more or less quantitatively, account for the observations. There was other evidence too, that I think I mentioned there. Jager and somebody else in the lab I was working with had suggested something of a similar nature.
For the moon?
Yeah.
Jager and somebody? Not Westphal, was it?
That wasn't Westphal.
Looking in the references, this Karslaw and Jager had the book that you used.
Oh, that's just the textbook.
Right. I don't find
it. I must have used it in a lab paper.
I think this is the first sort of analysis like this, other than by the infrared people that had gone into it a little bit, but nowhere near as much as this.
No, I think that broke some new ground.
Did you realize when you got into this project that you were going to do this sort of analysis, or did it only become apparent once you began to get the data?
Only after we got the data. It became apparent that there was something interesting there and that warranted a careful analysis.
But the first motivation to do it was simply to, let's see what the moon looks like. So, I gather then that you took this high-frequency equipment, seems like 600 megahertz was the lowest frequency that you worked with in those early days, and you were just going to try to look at everything that you could. And so we talked about the moon. You looked at the sun, of course. Did you study solar burst? I think you did also. You have this paper with Minute and 51 in which you break the sun up into three components. The quiet component, the slowly varying component, and the fluctuating component. Mm-hmm. And then you have this idea about the slowly varying component coming from very hot areas near sunspots where the this hot gas comes off of the sunspot. Do I have that right?
Yes. That led to a paper with Davies.
That's right.
In Nature, the origin of it, correct.
In 53.
53.
In the monthly notices and Nature. I am not in solar astronomy myself. How is that idea? Well, first of all, what was the origin of that idea? What was it in the data that made you say that this must be what's going on?
Well, I noticed that the solar radiation plotted against sunspot area was something like that.
A rising function,
With a base. Which didn't go to zero. Then what I tried to do then was to take account of the fact that there were never... that the radiation from sunspots, from the area region of sunspots, didn't cease when the sunspots disappeared. In other words, well, we know now it's an active region. The active region was active for quite a while after the sunspots. So statistically then, I tried to get rid of that residual effect. And what happened was that it seemed to come down to there.
I see.
In other words, all the corona came from sunspots and their residues. Well, that's basically correct as far as the radio data is concerned. There is a corona, of course, even in coronal hulls, but it's a very minute one. So that was roughly correct. And you can see that if you look at soft X-ray pictures of the sun. It's virtually a black disk with bright things like that. You'll have seen these.
Yes.
Well, that was the whole basis of that idea. That was violently opposed by the pundits.
By the pundits?
People at radio physics, too.
And so you also had a mention that another point that gave evidence for this was that it was only after several months of no spots that the so-called base component was seized. So there was a time lag.
Yeah, that's this sort of business. See, Pawsey had done this. That was sort of accepted as gospel.
Establish the base level as...
That's the Pawsey's quiet sun.
Right.
And then that's the effect of sunspots. And this is why it was so vigorously opposed, because that had been established and accepted in radiophysics. And I said, well, that's true to a point, but it's rather artificial, because when the sunspot goes, it wasn't the spot that was doing it, it was the magnetic field associated with the spot, and that's still there, which we know now 70 years. And if you allow for that and extrapolate back there, then you come down pretty well to zero, which was correct.
I see. Well, since you brought up this paper with Davies, it had a lot of statistical analysis of sunspot data and so forth. Was there any particular difficulty with that, in doing that?
Yes, it was very difficult to sort out this residual effect and make correct allowance for it. You could over allow for it or under allow. How much longer will we go on? I have to disappear for a...
So now we come to the monthly notices paper in 51, where you looked at the entire spectrum from 9 to 3,000 megahertz of the galactic background. And of course, for many years, and even to some extent still today, this has been a source of controversy as to what's going on. What was your opinion as these surveys began to unfold, the first surveys?
Well, as I recall, I first suggested that there were two, that the data proved that there were two separate components, one thermal and one non-thermal.
Your high frequency data was critical to establishing the thermal component, I presume.
Yes. Now, that was very controversial. The person who agreed with it wholeheartedly was Shlovsky. I don't know that his article was ever translated, but he sent me a copy and it was very flattering. He entirely agreed and said that it was a breakthrough and a very good idea.
Was that the one that was in 52 or 53 in Astronomische Journal, the Shlovsky article?
Well, I can't remember. It was in Russian.
Yeah. I think that was the one, yeah.
Mm. It was a long article and mainly devoted to a discussion of my publication.
And I think that's the article that's usually attributed, credited with first suggesting the corona. Is that correct?
I can't recall, but I thought from the very beginning that there was a corona, and I still think so, although it's still controversial.
Yeah.
I think the evidence is more and more in favor of a corona now. Yeah.
Who disagreed with this idea?
I can't recall. Most people seem to. I know that the people at Jodrell Bank did, and Hanbury Brown at the same time had published one in which he had a single component, I think. The whole thing was very much simplified. I had my thermal component was in the form of little blobs, if I recall, and I worked out that there'd be three of these in any given line of sight on an average. Hanbury Brown worked out something quite different.
Well, how could you work out how many there would be in the line of sight?
I can't recall.
Well, I'll be checking.
That's a long while ago.
Yeah. I've only checked the abstract, so I haven't went to the paper detail myself.
But the first theoretical paper was published, and then a later one was rejected. It had been sent to Ryle, and then it was sent to Jodrell Bank.
To Ryle as a referee, you mean?
Yes.
For monthly notices or something?
Yes, I think it would be monthly notices. And they both objected to it because it didn't agree with their own models. And so that was the end of it.
That was never published.
I didn't persist with that, no.
The But you say the galactic background probably partly is hot interstellar gas and partly stellar atmospheres at low frequency. So you were thinking of the background as being the integrated effect of true radio stars in some sense?
Well, I can't recall that. If I did, I'd long rejected that idea of anything stellar. The furthest back I can recall is a general background of rather uniform radiation from very fast particles in the magnetic field, and thermal radiation from blobs of gas, H2 regions.
Right, but this paper in 51, which was presumably was written in 1950 or so, is long before synchrotron radiation was accepted in any sense. It had been suggested in a couple short papers, but I think it's fair to say that it was only 2 or 3 years later when the Russian astrophysicists began to push it that it became accepted.
That's right, yes. Well, that may have given Shlomsky the idea. That's maybe, I think I referred to it as a non-thermal component.
Yes, right, from these presumed stars.
Yeah. I didn't know what... I had no idea of synchrotron radiation. I had very little formal training in those areas, being an engineer.
Which, of course, was, but this was not unusual. Most people were talking about some kind of different kind of radio star, very different from the Sun.
Yes.
And let's see, the later paper that you wrote on the galactic background that you referred to, that would be... I don't see that paper. Did you say there was a later paper on the galactic background that you wrote?
That would be the second one.
Oh, that's the one that wasn't published. Yes, right.
Yes. But enlarged on that model. And, I think it would have been quite a useful paper.
But it was...
rendered so much trouble. And also, as you probably heard, I was having a lot of personal trouble with radio physics. Alan and I got on very badly.
I see.
And if I struck any trouble overseas in referee form, which occasionally happens to anybody, of course, that gave him the opportunity to jump on me.
Well, I also understand from talking to other people that there was a rather strict internal refereeing system of radio physics. Is that correct?
Yes.
How did this operate?
Well, very badly, I think. I'd always recommend... I'd always like to have internal refereeing because it costs you nothing. You get opinions, as long as it's not carried too far. But I can recall very well a theoretical paper some years later being refereed by Bolton, who knew nothing about it, and who said he couldn't pass it. He simply knew nothing about it. He couldn't offer any sensible comments on it. But for your information,
yes,
you probably know, the source of cosmic radio emission as synchrotron emission, first proposed by Alfvén and Herlufsen.
That's the papers I was referring to.
And yeah, and Kiepenheuer. They were both in 1950.
Right,
I don't think many people
took
much notice of it.
That's quite correct. And it was really the Shlomsky and the other astrophysicists in Russia pushed it 3 years later or so. So once the Russians began pushing this, did you like this idea of synchrotron radiation?
Yes. I think everybody liked that. It was the answer. Something we knew nothing about. We knew nothing about relativistic particles and so on. That was just a blank area, and they filled it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on to your actual observations with Harry Minnett of the galactic background at 12, 10, and 3,000 megahertz. What do you think were the main results that came out of these high-frequency observations? Although, like you say, you couldn't do that much, but you did still do some useful things.
Well, I think the main thing was that it extended the spectrum far enough to show that there were two components, one thermal and one that couldn't possibly be thermal.
And you did look at some discrete sources also, in particular finding that Centaurus A had a very steep spectrum and Taurus A had a flat spectrum. And what did you make of that, to have such different behavior?
Well, I don't recall. I suppose that confirmed our ideas of different origins. But I do remember we discovered what